But first, Bruce Shapiro, with the increasingly heavy responsibility of making sense of America. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Always glad to be here. Responsibilities notwithstanding.
Bruce, have I got this straight? Hidden in a food truck, Trump was smuggled across the tarmac at Ankara from Air Force One to an ordinary military plane in order to be flown to Britain. Is that what happened?
This is what the Washington Post is now reporting, and the New York Times is now reporting. The Post broke it. Full credit to them. I mean, you know, not to minimize threats from Iran or anyone else to the president of the United States, but, you know, if I were looking for a hidden Donald Trump, first place I would look would be the food cart. I'm sorry. It's a...
You are a cruel man. You are a cruel man.
It's a cruel world. This is a strange story. It is significant in that it speaks to really two important policy issues. One is the way that the war with Iran has, in fact, of course, ratcheted up some significant threats. There were jitters over the past week involving threats to water supplies around the U.S., which are all locally controlled and have a variety of security protocols. And, you know, Iran is a country that has sometimes acted abroad, assassinations abroad and other things. That would be something you might expect as a threat in asymmetrical warfare. It also speaks to the kind of vanity and corruption of Trump's deal with Qatar for the new fancy Air Force One, the plane he would have preferred to be flying, food cart or no, but which lacked the key security features that would have been required to get him safely out of Turkey after the NATO summit. So, behind the entertaining scenario of the president of the United States being hustled into a, you know, refrigerator box to get him out of Turkey is the really serious damage being done on several different fronts by the Trump presidency. It's an interesting story.
But Bruce, given the fact that the United States and Israel between them assassinated the entire leadership of Iran, I'm not suggesting for a moment that there is a right of retaliation here, but it should surely be a cause for security concern in the president of the United States, you know. America having wiped out the leadership of Iran makes the leadership of the United States, I would have thought, very vulnerable.
Look, part of the problem that Trump is in now with Iran is that he went into it a little over 6 months ago thinking for some reason that this was going to be a quick and easy victory like Venezuela, not a deeply entrenched, hardened, decades-long regime that has well-established plans for defending itself in the case of outside attack and that has a long history of acts abroad. So I think failure to see the kinds of threats that could arise, whether it was the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, which of course now has given Iran more negotiating power than all of the nuclear weapons they'd ever envisioned developing, and whether it's that, the military stalemate, the complications for regional partners like Oman and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Jordan, none of those were foreseen in the war planning. So it's really no surprise that the president's own physical safety or the safety of American water supplies were not put into the calculation 6 months ago.
Were you being fair then, Bruce? I mean, you say none of these things were foreseen, but don't we know from that extraordinary book by Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan that, in fact, Trump was briefed on all of these dangers. He was told what would happen, and he ignored them.
Well, by not foreseen, I mean not foreseen, not calculated into the plan as it went forward, yeah. Of course. You know, even within the Trump White House and within the State Department and within the Defense Department, there are remaining experts, those who have not been purged, who have deep knowledge of Iran and the kind of politics that might even have favored a very robust Iran policy, right? But who were warning of exactly these kinds of outcomes. You know, there's a war within the administration about it. We saw reporting this week that General Dan Kane, whom Trump publicly at least likes to praise, has been warning of the significance of depleted weapon stockpiles, that the kind of global calculus of weaponry is going to be profoundly affected by this in ways that will be of great interest to Russia and probably in particular China. One of the strange results of this war is that a presidency that came to power focused on the presumed national security threat from China has ended up strengthening China's hand just as much as it has strengthening Iran's. Again, you know, you'd have to go pretty far back in American history, even through the history of quagmires like Vietnam, to find a war that in purely military terms and purely diplomatic terms was so quickly evident to be so stupid, so badly planned.
Well, to the home front and the selection of Dr. Abdul El Sayed as the Democratic Senate candidate for the midterms, beating Congresswoman Haley Stevens. Now, what does this mean for the Democratic Party? Abdul Sayed, I mean, the man's a spunk. He's a doctor, Rhodes Scholar. He's a writer on medicine. He's obviously extraordinarily intelligent. He's got a pretty radical program. He wants Medicare for all United States citizens, which, you know, is an impossibility.
Heaven forfend.
I mean, every other civilized country in the world, but not the United States. I mean, this man has caused profound distress within the Democratic Party establishment because he was chosen by Democrats to fight for the Senate. Why?
Well, okay, first of all, Abdul Sayed is kind of like, in a sense, like Mamdani, clearly a politician of exceptional gifts. Michigan, the state that he is going to be running in, is not only in the middle of the country, it's an incredibly diverse state that is the home of Detroit, of the auto manufacturing industry, vast swaths of working class Americans in cities like Detroit and Grand Rapids and elsewhere. It's a state that has huge rural areas and smaller cities that have been profoundly impacted by the opioid crisis and by unemployment. It's got rural farming. It's a complicated place and one of the kind of bellwether states in the country. And of course, it's also attracting so much attention because control of the Senate is up for grabs. It seemed out of sight for Democrats just a few months ago, but it is very much a 50-50 proposition. So there is a lot at stake in this race. Enter Dr. Abdul El Sayed, who has run before as a known quantity in Michigan, experienced campaigner, former public health official, who does have these really progressive politics. Now, he defines himself as a capitalist, but his political platform might be described as, you know, democratic socialist light, with things like Medicare for all. He is, of course, quite outspoken on Gaza.
Yep.
And the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, which represents the interests of the Netanyahu government in a very robust way in American politics, poured a record amount of money into this race, as did a number of other outside actors.
It was $30 million, wasn't it?
It was a vast amount of money.
Spent to protect the interests of Israel in a pre-selection contest in Michigan.
And it didn't work, right? What's really interesting here is that AIPAC, which has long seemed a kind of invulnerable juggernaut in American politics and gets portrayed that way by its enemies as well as perceived that way by Israel's defenders, has clearly, AIPAC stock has fallen as a result of this. Now, it should be said that Haley Stevens, the quite experienced member of Congress who was running against El-Sayed, while a moderate in Democratic Party terms, closer to the party's center, is a social liberal, a political liberal, would be progressive on most social issues. The most significant policy difference between her and El-Sayed, other than gradualism on things like Medicare for All, would be about Israel. She's also seen as an establishment figure, an inside figure who was endorsed by the governor, Gretchen Whitmer, someone with kind of deep roots. And what I found actually most interesting about this is that given the bitterness that this race evoked within Democratic Party ranks, in part over Israel, in part over the perceived movement of the party leftward and the success of insurgent leftish candidates in this year's primaries, which has party technocrats in a kind of uproar. In the midst of that, both Stevens and Abdul El-Sayed made it very clear, as this very bitter campaign came to an end, that they were going to support the winner, whoever it was. They appeared together immediately after this very close primary. And they're trying to project, within Michigan anyway, a kind of unity, which is the opposite of what I think a lot of the party apparatchiks were hoping that there would be a kind of a rout of the progressives. That clearly didn't happen. What I found interesting, actually, looking at the numbers, though, is that while El-Sayed's victory is notable, an earthquake, as my colleagues in Nation Magazine called it. It is a kind of progressive earthquake in American politics, given the visibility of the race. It actually was much closer than people expected. The final polls in the few weeks showed El-Sayed beating Stevens in a blowout, and that didn't happen. It came down to countable thousands of votes that took nearly a day to calculate, really, really a close race. And Stevens, the kind of more establishment candidate, did very well in some very important pockets. She did extremely well in Detroit, Wayne County, that area, partly because of communities with a large Jewish vote, partly because of African-American voters in Detroit who went her way more than they went El-Sayed's, in some other cities because of union support. Clearly, the party really is having a conversation. This was a very close race.
Yeah.
And the question now facing Democrats going forward, not only in Michigan, but around the country in states like Wisconsin and Colorado and Maine, where there have been, in some cases, still primaries going on, in other cases, primaries that have already happened, where you've got, on the one hand, progressives, some of them in the Democratic Socialists of America, one of the factions, some of them, like El-Sayed, more general progressives in the sort of Bernie Sanders socialist tradition, was really kind of, I would say, a social democrat in European terms, different those traditions. And then you've got the people who are sometimes described as party centrists, but who are really the heirs to the Bill and Hillary Clinton vision of American politics as in the province of socially liberal, economically neoliberal technocrats, those folks are sounding an alarm. And then you've got real conservative Democrats, got something called Third Way, which is a kind of organizing vehicle for Democrats. It's a reinvention of a conservative Democratic vehicle going back decades called the Democratic Leadership Council, which people like former Vice President Joe Lieberman, who thought all of this liberal stuff was getting to be too much and the party needed to slow down. That faction, too, is trying to kind of seize the wheel of the car. It will be interesting to see how this plays out, especially because we are now 3 weeks away from the Labor Day holiday, the first Monday in September, which is traditionally the kickoff, really, of the fall election season. Everything else now has been pregame. And, you know, the final thing I would say, one reason that I think progressives are thrilled by El Sayed as they were by Mamdani, as they are by some of the other primaries going on around the country, need to be paying attention and need to be cautious in their expectations and need to be looking, in fact, at how El Sayed and Haley Stevens have worked going forward, is that there is a long history of periodic waves of progressives who can do very well in party primaries, because in primaries, turnout is typically much lower than the general election. It may be a third or a quarter or half of what it would be in the general election. That certainly was the case in Michigan. Even in a relatively high turnout primary, in which there was a lot of interest, it's far smaller than the numbers who show up in November. So it's easy to seize control. Not easy, these are hard races, but it's totally attainable to seize a nomination in a party primary as an insurgent.
Right.
Much harder to win the general election. And the Republicans know this too, right? This is
now,
how you
on that
end up
point, Bruce,
party,
on that point, Bruce, we have to we have to withdraw from the United States. There are other parts of the world that we're paying attention to tonight. Bruce, much more to talk about this in the weeks ahead. Thank you so much for joining the show, contributing editor for The Nation, of course, executive director of the Global Center for Journalism and Trauma.